It soon became too much. After the first few months of publicity, the siege seemed to lift, but this was only the prelude to the second act. Fac-simmed tabloids referred to Saul as the wandering Jew, the desperate father wandering afar in search of a cure for his child's bizarre illness, an ironic title, given Saul's lifelong dislike of travel. Sarai inevitably was the grieving mother, Rachel was the doomed child, or in one inspired headline, virgin victim of the Time Tomb's curse. None of the family could go outside without finding a newsteep or imager hiding behind a tree. Crawford discovered that there was money to be found in the Weintraub's misfortune. At first, the town held the line, but when entrepreneurs from Bassard City moved in with gift shops, T-shirt concessions, tours, and data chip booths for the tourists who were coming in larger and larger numbers, the local business people first dithered, then wavered, then decided unanimously that if there was commerce to be carried on, the profits should not go to outsiders. After 438 standard years of comparative solitude, the town of Crawford received a Farcaster Terminex. No longer did visitors have to suffer the 20-minute flight from Bassard City. The crowds grew. On the day they moved, it rained heavily, and the streets were empty. Rachel did not cry, but her eyes were very wide all day, and she spoke in subdued tones. It was 10 days before her 6th birthday.
"But, Daddy, why do we have to move?"
"We just do, honey."
"But why?"
"It's something we have to do, little one. You'll like Hebron. There are lots of parks there."
"But how come you never said we were going to move?"
"We did, sweetie. You must have forgotten."
"But what about Graham and Grams and Uncle Richard and Aunt Tetha and Uncle Saul and everybody?"
"They can come visit us any time."
"But what about Nikki and Lina and my friends?"
Saul said nothing but carried the last of the luggage to the EMV. The house was sold and empty. Furniture had been sold or sent ahead to Hebron. For a week, there had been a steady stream of family and old friends, college associates, and even some of the Reich's med team who had worked with Rachel for 18 years. But now, the street was empty. Rain streaked the perspex canopy of the old EMV and ran in complex rivulets. The three of them sat in the vehicle for a moment, staring at the house. The interior smelled of wet wool and wet hair. Rachel clutched the teddy bear Sarai had resurrected from the attic 6 months earlier. She said,
"It's not fair."
"No," agreed Saul. "It's not fair." Hebron was a desert world. 4 centuries of terraforming had made the atmosphere breathable and a few million acres of land arable. The creatures which had lived there before were small and tough and infinitely wary, and so were the creatures imported from old Earth, including the humankind. "Ah," gasped Saul the day they arrived in the sun-baked village of Dan above the sun-baked kibbutz of Kfar Shalom. "What masochists we Jews are! 20,000 surveyed worlds fit our kind when the Hegira began, and those schmucks came here." But it was not masochism which brought either the first colonists or Saul and his family. Hebron was mostly desert, but the fertile areas were almost frighteningly fertile. Sinai University was respected throughout the web, and its med center brought in wealthy patients and a healthy income for the cooperative. Hebron had a single Farcaster Terminex in New Jerusalem and allowed portals nowhere else. Belonging to neither the hegemony nor protectorate, Hebron taxed travelers heavily for Farcaster privilege and allowed no tourists outside New Jerusalem. For a Jew seeking privacy, it was perhaps the safest place in 300 worlds trod by man. The kibbutz was more a cooperative by tradition than in operation. The Weintraubs were welcomed to their home, a modest place, offering sun-dried adobe, curves instead of right angles, and bare wood floors, but also offering a view from the hill which showed an infinite expanse of desert beyond the orange and olive groves. The sun seemed to dry up everything, thought Saul, even worries and bad dreams. The light was a physical thing. In the evening their house glowed pink for an hour after the sun had set. Each morning Saul sat by his daughter's bed until she awoke. The first minutes of her confusion were always painful to him, but he made sure that he was the first thing Rachel saw each day. He held her while she asked her questions. "Where are we, Daddy?" "In a wonderful place, little one. I'll tell you all about it over breakfast." "How did we get here?" "By casting and flying and walking a bit," he would say. "It's not so far away, but far enough to make it an adventure." "But my bed's here, my stuffed animals. Why don't I remember coming?" And Saul would hold her gently by the shoulders and look into her brown eyes and say, "You had an accident, Rachel. Remember in The Homesick Toad, where Terence hits his head and forgets where he lives for a few days? It was sort of like that." "Am I better?" "Yes," Saul would say. "You're all better now." And the house would fill with the smell of breakfast, and they would go out to the terrace where Saray waited. Rachel had more playmates than ever. The kibbutz cooperative had a school where she was always the welcome visitor, greeted anew each day. In the long afternoons, the children played in the orchards and explored along the cliffs. Avner, Robert, and Ephraim, the council elders, urged Saul to work on his book. Hebron prided itself on the number of scholars, artists, musicians, philosophers, writers, and composers it sheltered as citizens and long-term residents. The house, they pointed out, was a gift of the state. Saul's pension, though small by Webb standards, was more than adequate for their modest needs in Kfar Shalom. To Saul's surprise, however, he found that he enjoyed physical labor. Whether working in the orchards or clearing stones in the unclaimed fields or repairing a wall above the city, Saul found that his mind and spirit were freer than they had been in many years. He discovered that he could wrestle with Kierkegaard while he waited for mortar to dry and find new insights in Kant and Van Dur while carefully checking the apples for worms. At the age of 73 standard, Saul earned his first calluses. In the evenings, he would play with Rachel and then take a walk in the foothills with Saray as Judy or one of the other neighbor girls watched their sleeping child. One weekend, they went away to New Jerusalem, just Saul and Saray. The first time they had been alone together for that long since Rachel returned to live with them 17 standard years before. But everything was not idyllic. Too frequent were the nights when Saul awoke alone and walked barefoot down the hall to see Saray watching over Rachel in her sleep. And often, at the end of a long day, bathing Rachel in the old ceramic tub or tucking her in as the walls glowed pinkly, the child would say, "I like it here, Daddy, but can we go home tomorrow?" And Saul would nod. And after the goodnight story and the lullaby and the goodnight kiss, sure that she was asleep, he would begin to tiptoe out of the room only to hear the muffled, "Later, alligator," from the blanketed form on the bed, to which he had to reply, "Wild crocodile." And lying in bed himself, next to the softly breathing and possibly sleeping length of the woman he loved, Saul would watch the strips of pale light from one or both of Hebron's small moons move across the rough walls, and he would talk to God.